This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we take a closer look and a listen to some of Hawaii's oral history. Thanks to the work of the University of Hawaii's Oral History Center, we can hear directly from those who experienced certain events in our past. Today, the focus is on the tsunami that struck Hilo in April 1st, 1946. We're going to hear voices from those who experienced it in Hilo and those who helped in the recovery efforts. We'll also talk about oral history with Daviana McGregor, the director of the University of Hawaii's Oral History Center. And we'll talk about natural disasters, recovery, and preparations from tsunami to volcanoes with Ken Rubin with the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we'd like to hear from you. What stories have you heard about the April Fool's Day tsunami of 1946? Have you had the opportunity to talk story with relatives who experienced it? And what kind of stories would you like to preserve as oral histories? If you have any questions for Daviana, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at 808-941-3689. And HPR News Director Bill Dorman is here this morning in the studio. He's going to start us off setting the stage by introducing us to the people sharing their stories.
Catherine, good morning. This was the most destructive tsunami to hit Hawaii in modern times. It killed 159 people, destroyed more than 500 homes and other buildings. The overall damages estimated at the time to be $26 million. Now, accounting for inflation, it's the equivalent today of more than $326 million in damages. All started with a powerful earthquake hitting the Aleutian Islands off the coast of Alaska, estimated at 8.6. One of the first casualties, the Scotch Cap Lighthouse on Unimak Island, the largest island in the Aleutians. All five lighthouse keepers were killed. No one could sound any kind of an alarm. It took nearly 5 hours for the first waves of destruction to roll into Hilo. And when they arrived, it was a shock. Alexander Riviere was 15 years old. He was headed to school the morning of April 1st, 1946. He shared his memories in an interview recorded in February 1999.
That particular morning was a very strange, was sort of a grayish morning, you know. Overcasted skies and stuff like that. I can remember that. And while I was walking down, I came by Skipper's Cove by Waikia Theater. I saw this great big eel. Big, looked like a snake, eh? Yeah. But it was coiling and uncoiling this up in the middle of the road, you know. Oh. And I seen water over there.
Yeah.
But there was water. And something strange about this. But people said, tidal wave, you know, no go school, tidal wave. What I gonna know about tidal wave? I don't even know what a tsunami is. You know, now we call it tsunami. I didn't even know about that particular day was All Fool's Day until I remember that. That time somebody telling me tidal wave. This guy's been pulling my leg again. You know, so I went across that, and I was atop the bridge, and here I am looking at, you know, just like when you look over a horizon, but here the water was going out. And they were really, really going out far. I could see the Hilo Bay. I could see the bottom as in that wave coming. You know, it was very, very big one. Very, very big. It seemed as though you could just like it was boiling. Boy, I'm telling you, it was the biggest and ugliest thing. Because it was black. It was black. You know, the water over there is black because you have that black sand beach. So catch, we gotta run. I don't know if we're gonna make it. We're up.
When you saw it, where were you standing?
On the very center of the bridge. We could have been safe there, you know. But what happened next, I would say no, because you see the whole bridge lift up. We ran up. I pushed in my hand. We started to run up Manono Street. So we ran in full strength because we had to get away. We had to save our lives. It did not dawn on me that we were saving our lives. You know, when it hit us, we were upside down already. We were all wet. So we managed to get back to our home using the railroad tracks that we used to go by, because they used to pass right in front of my house. My mom was already home, and that she was the one that told my dad that probably I had gotten killed, you know, in the wave, because I had gone to school at 7 o'clock. Yeah. The wave hit the main wave, one hit, not 7:05. See, my dad was working in Kamoala. So when he got the report, he said, you better go home because they have a tied away with something in the Hilo. So when he had saw me, he put his arm around me, he was kissing me in my mind. He was so happy to see me alive. But it was, it probably gave me a couple of slaps too.
The chaos of that morning, he found his way home by following the railroad tracks. Another survivor called that first huge wave, she saw a great big black wall. James Lowe was 16 years old when he was nearly caught in the middle of it, driving down a road when he came up upon a policeman who probably saved his life.
As I headed down that road, on just about the bottom of that road, just when I began to enter Cam Avenue, a policeman, and I wish I knew his name because it has some bearing or some impact on me because I've wondered from that day on to today. You know, I just want to know who that person was. Not that he was sarcastic in any way, but when I got to that corner, he made the corner coming in from the Hilo side of that corner, turning up Kumu, and told me to get out of there. He yelled at me to get out of there. So I was shocked. So I just sat there, kind of wondering why he did that. And in the meantime, when I pulled my head up to look out towards the ocean. And lo and behold, I've never seen anything like it in my life, but it was this huge, huge, huge wave. I think I wouldn't be exaggerating, but it was taller than the AmFac building, the American Factors building that was sitting right on the ocean side of Cam Avenue. And by that time, I didn't know what, you know, I was kind of puzzled. I didn't know what to do. So I wanted to turn around, so I turned the car into Island Motors, and by that time the water had already struck, and I was already sitting in neck high deep water in the automobile, feeling, and I could feel the car kind of floating, with the force of the wave that came in. Well, when I finally came to my senses, I felt the car being sucked out back towards the ocean. As the wave receded, and I, at that point in time, jumped out of the car, climbed through the window, not even thinking about opening the door, I jumped out of the window, and headed up upland. I struggled through that current that was pulling everything back out towards the ocean, the receding tide, and I finally got to a fenced area that was situated between Island Motors and Motos Inn. And I was fortunate enough to grab that fence and climb over it where the current wasn't, or the receding tide wasn't as strong. And from there, I made my way up Kumu Street and back home.
Just incredible stories of escape and survival. Hilo suffered the most losses from the tsunami in 1946, both in terms of human life and in property, but other areas were hit as well. Lapahoehoe on the Hamakua coast, 25 people killed, including students and a teacher who were in a school when the first wave struck. At least 77 homes on Maui were destroyed, but it was Hilo that took the most direct impact. And it was Hilo where the comeback was the most difficult. Areas where waves crashed through were just changed forever. Lenora Van Giesen was 11 years old. She remembers growing up around neighborhoods that became very different. And in the short term, for her family, it meant a move.
We moved up to the volcano. And that was because a home was given to us, you know, for the youth until they rebuilt our home, until my parents figured out what they were going to do. And we stayed there all summer, coming down, you know. And while school was still in session, we'd come down every day. My father would go to work, we would go to school. And when he was through work, then we'd go back up to the volcano. My mom stayed up there. Mm-hmm. And then we moved back, I would say at the end of summer, to the same place. The only thing, the house we stayed in was a lot smaller and not in the same location. You know, it was where the original home landed in Philippopch.
How did life change in Kilkaha after?
We became closer. All the survivors that we met, all these children from the other side, you know, like from the Cooks, we would go up to the Cooks before 46, but after 46, we would go down to Richardson. And we became a very close unit. We would support each other, we'd do things together, you know.
Well, why is that, though?
I because we were the same age. But still today, you know, we see each other, we still support each other.
But prior to the tsunami, you folks didn't...
Well, we didn't go too far, I guess because we're younger yet now. We're below 11 now.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't go as far as Cook's house, you know, play with the children up to the Cook's house, mm-hmm. play with the Psyche's grandchildren, mm-hmm. know all of them, and that was it. But after the tidal wave, now we're bigger. So we used to go with our bikes, and we all made friends, and we all got along.
And who moved out from Kyoto because of 46?
Austin's moved out, the Waits moved out, Carter came back. I would say the Kamais moved out, the Lulas moved out, the Furtados moved out, the Lalakias moved out. The Martins never rebuilt, Lalakia never rebuilt, they sold instead. The Poors never rebuilt. The Kais, the family sold the property.
So after, you know, these people never came back, mm-hmm. and they sold, who did they sell to? Did the neighborhood change at all?
No, because we're still our own group, and we just hung out with each other, you know. Now it's a different type of community down there. We don't know too many people down there, so. But we still stayed in contact with each other, you know, even after we moved away different places. But we'll always go back. We'll go back, go swimming, you know. We'll find reasons to go down, but you always find us around the beach.
So you had your core.
Yeah.
Your core.
Oh, yeah. We still have our core group. In fact, we're planning a neighborhood reunion next year where we won't be involved with a tsunami reunion. We're just going to do a neighborhood reunion. Mm-hmm. So that will probably be another wonderful time.
All those families hit by the 1946 tsunami, some who stayed, many who moved, some who didn't or couldn't rebuild. That interview, by the way, was done in 1999 by Warren Nishimoto, who did most of these interviews. He was the director of the Center for Oral History for many years, recorded interviews for more than 30 years. He also spoke with a man who was on duty as a policeman that April day in 1946 when the tsunami struck, Robert Chow, nicknamed Steamy. Was called on to help with a truly difficult job.
When I was asked to go down to the ice house, which is the Hilo Electric Light Ice House, it was a temporary morgue in the first locker. I was asked to go down there to try and identify bodies. And there, I couldn't identify the bodies, but it was real sickening to see small ones, several years old, among the victims. The Boy Scouts were around, trying to help identify or recover certain things. And the labor union volunteered to work. And the plantations and the big construction companies furnished all the equipment. So they were working, cleaning up mess.
They start cleaning up that day?
They start doing it that day. And the county, the state use their equipment and the labor work, they work continuously. So that it wasn't just I'm putting 8 hours, that's all. They just continue working because most of the workers had families, victims, so they want to help, and there's a lot of volunteers wanted to help, and yet there's a lot of people there looking for bargains. It's not looting because they discarded already, but they go down there and see what they can get. I didn't go down there, but they said there's more people down there than people helping. So there are a lot of things that were just with a bulldozer go right through, the crane, put it in the truck, and off they go down to the rubbish dump.
Did you actually see people looting, you know, taking merchandise?
Yeah, we've seen
the cleanup now.
Yeah, the cleaning up. People would take some things and say, oh, so-and-so told me I could have it. And if you know who they are and who the owner was before, you can put two and two together
you let them go. We, you know, take their word for it. So that's how, in those days, we control a crowd, because not like now, too many outsiders or people that you don't know. It's hard to control.
How long did it take to actually clean up?
Anything from 2 weeks to a month or longer.
Steamy Chow is still on the police force in Hilo on May 23, 1960, when an 8.3 quake struck off the coast of Chile, and the tsunami that followed it again rocked Hilo, killing 61 people. Husei Takaki was another resident of Hilo back in 1946. She lived in a part of town called Shinmachi, or New Town. That area was devastated by the tsunami, and her house was no exception. She lost her parents, a niece, a nephew. And in the midst of the tragedy, she had to move, and move very quickly.
Before we evacuate, my sister came. My elder sister came with losing a child. And she said, oh, I lost Vivian. I said, oh, auntie, mom, Nissan, you can help. You know, everyone went through that. I think I lost mom and dad. And here we was crying. But she was, I said, no more time for me crying because there's so many people, you know, then we have to evacuate that. So we evacuated and went someplace. I don't know where we went, to Sprint's house, you know. Stayed there for one day. Then they fed us lunch, you know. But we just, that's why I used to see Chicken House, and I said, you chicken, you're lucky you have a house to leave. We don't have anybody, no place to go. We don't know where to go. That was the worst miserable time that we had. But from there on, we found houses, stayed one day, one night, and you know. Then we had a lady friend that had a friend that house was empty, so she rented that. So we lived with them for a while. So each one has to find their own way to live, you know. But there were about 3 or 4 Japanese schools. So I guess some of those places they use as a housing for the people that had lost everything. And NAS, airport, they used to have army barracks.
Oh, Naval Air Station, yeah?
Yeah, so a lot of people were housing there.
Where were you staying?
We were living in Pew Pew Street for 3 months.
With a friend?
A friend.
I see.
Then after that, they had houses available up that down. You know where the civic auditorium is?
Yeah.
Around there, they used to have army camp. And houses individually, you know. So we had lived there for 4 years. They used to have, you know, barracks. After barracks, line up. And then the screen will be open this month, so on a rainy day, windstorm, the wind used to blow into our bedroom, we couldn't sleep. But what choice we had? Then individual they started to settle in. So that's where all these people bought Iwalani Street. Those are most of them are tidal victims.
46
Yeah. We at that time we had house where we lived until I was able to get doctor's house residence and watch the hospital. That was my life, you know. And I stayed in the doctor's house hospital, so I had to get up 2 o'clock in the morning, 1 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes they had asthma, they can't breathe.
The 1946 tsunami changed so many lives in Hawaii, especially in Hilo. But it also led to some changes, including the first efforts by the U.S. federal government to create the capability of an early warning system. 3 years later, in 1949, the government set up what is now the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center.
Wow, that's incredible history. Incredible history. Mm-hmm. Chicken voices. Skin. I mean, just listening to these stories, because this is the first time that I'm hearing it, you know, the description of the man in the car up to his neck in water. Mm. Wow. Well, what was it like for you, Debbie, when you were listening to this?
it's incredible how shocking it must have been for them. And I read the transcripts, but this is the first time I'm actually hearing the voices. And it makes a huge difference to hear the emotion that goes with the story as they're telling it, than just seeing it on the pages, which is why in our efforts now with the Center for Oral History, we're trying to have podcasts and other ways to have these voices be more accessible to our community, to build a sense of community and a sense of, and learn from these experiences.
If you're just joining us, our guests in the studio are Debiana McGregor, director for the Center for Oral History, and Ken Rubin also joins us with the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. What about you, Ken, if you're here just hearing this for the first time, too?
Yeah, and one of the things that struck me is, in addition to all the emotion, were the factoids that are embedded in a lot of these conversations, things that that we'd like the populace to know. For instance, that the water recedes oftentimes before a tsunami, that when it comes in as a wave, it's more like a tide than it is like a wave that you would surf at the beach. And that there's a series of waves, and so not only is the water coming in a problem, but also the receding water. And one of those interviews talked a lot about fighting that current. It's a really interesting thing to hear it in people's voices. But these are all things that we know happen during tsunami. They can take place over quite a period of time as the waves come in and go out, and really very hazardous situation, and you hear that represented in those voices.
Right, because you were talking earlier, and you said that sometimes it's the person's account, you just glean so much new information about what was happening at the time.
Yeah.
Amazing. Mm. I know just things that struck me, the light keepers that were killed.
Mm. Yeah. And that, when you look at time and things that are different now, in terms of now, we get just over the weekend, there was a, just last night, there was a notice, earthquake Vancouver Island, 6.8 magnitude, and then immediately Pacific Tsunami Warning Center reports no tsunami threat to Hawaii Island or to the islands generally. But to be in an age where that was not an option, to know that, to have that advanced knowledge is just chilling, and to hear that those voices of, oh, it's April Fool's Day, somebody, pulling my leg on this, just astounding.
Right, and I know we've been hearing about the War of the Worlds broadcast. We've had the missile alert from earlier this year, and we just know, if something happens, just kind of the terror that you go through, thinking that your life could be in danger because of something like this.
But it also really brings out just that value of oral history, because hearing the voices, there really is no substitute for that. And I'm excited to be working with the UH Oral History Center to be able to bring more of those voices from Hawaii's mm-hmm. history into the ears of our listeners.
Yeah, so we have 800 people that under the previous director Warren Nishimoto and his predecessor Chad Taniguchi that they had interviewed, and we have 30,000 pages of transcripts. And
wow.
What we're doing now is to go through and to get excerpts from the transcripts and piece together these podcast so we could take the voices and have those voices live on and learn the lessons from their experience, because as Ken could probably tell us, if there was a tsunami generated in Hawaii from a earthquake, we would be in the same situation they found themselves in. We would have to rely on our observations and be quick and respond as soon as we can, because we would only have a short response time and hardly any warning time.
And Ken, we were chatting about the accounts of first-person accounts of what's happening. And, you know, in this day and age, we've got technology, we've got tweets, we've got, you know, this, that, and the other. What brings, you know, all this to mind as far as what we need to know?
Well, one of the things we know about communities and their resilience in the face of disasters is that experience and collective knowledge are really important in, you know, providing resilience to that community. And in, you know, in places where natural disasters happen frequently, then that's sort of built in. A lot of people are aware of this. In places where they happen less frequently, meaning sort of once or maybe twice a generation, sometimes that information isn't as collectivized as it could be. And one of the ways that, that technology has brought the world together is that, you know, not only are we aware now of events that happen in Hawaii, but we're aware of events that happen around the world. Some of them are similar, some of them aren't. But they give us a means of communication that is very, very important. And especially as an event is evolving, people now have the ability in almost real time to communicate with each other via text or social media. And that can be a good thing. It can also be the spread of misinformation. But together, I think those put us into a different place as we approach the future of sort of disaster management and disaster science and helping communities cope and respond. As Daviana said, a locally generated tsunami wouldn't give us the kinds of warnings that we would get with these ones that are that happened in the far field, like the 1946 event. And so we have to rely on our own kind of community knowledge and community response to quickly respond to those events.
Okay, so hold that thought because you've got to take a break. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Today we're talking oral histories, in particular the deadly Hilo tsunami of 1946. You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kauai author Bill Fernandez, whose writings weave Hawaiian history into mystery novels and memoirs. Learn more at kauaibillfernandez.com.
True encounters with Pele, shark people, and a kissing ghost? Hear these and other spooky stories told by master storytellers Jeff Gere and Alton Chung in HPR's darkened Atherton studio on Halloween night. This is not for kids or the faint of heart, but if you love a good scare, call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
You are back with The Conversation. You know, and Ken, you know, we were talking about, you know, good information, right, in this day of social media. What do you think is important? I mean, we've had a situation here where we had the king tides and we had citizen science kind of coming out as a way for everyone to contribute to kind of our general knowledge. What else is important to know?
Well, I think one thing we can do is take our cues from traditional societies. For instance, the Hawaiian societies that existed, you know, very effectively here for 1,000 years or more pre-contact, where people were generally aware of their environment. They were aware of the place that they lived, what was normal, what wasn't normal. There was some kind of collective knowledge about how things work, at least in a way that impacts their daily lives. And something that with our current culture and way of life, sometimes people get a little bit disconnected from, right? They spend a lot of time in an environment that is sort of artificial, and we get our information by indirect means instead of by experiencing it ourselves. And so building back into communities some combination of collective knowledge through experience or shared experience, you know, talking with our kupuna or whoever it is, family members who may have experienced something, and also being educated about, you know, what is possible, what isn't possible, what might be a conspiracy theory versus what's something that has happened here in the past. All these things are important.
You know, and Daviana, I know, I think it's the Nanakuli Library that it's going to debut a new podcasting studio, and I was talking with the head librarian, and she said that request was something that came out of the community, that the Kupuna, the community wanted to record the stories of the Kupuna, which is a fabulous thing.
Yeah, and I think that's really wonderful. I think our center would like to partner with Nanakuli and other communities to provide training workshops and make know what kind of equipment to acquire and to get involved in collecting the history of their own community. So we have our own projects. We're right now doing a history of the Constitutional Convention that was held in 1978 together with Gerald Kato from School of Communications and Colin Moore from Public Policy Administration. And then we're also planning to do a history of the Koholawe Aloha Aina movement. And then we want to interview individuals as well. So people call in and they ask us if we can come and interview their kupuna, and we're willing to do that. But we're also willing to go out into communities and provide workshops and advice on what kind of equipment to get so that the community can be involved in collecting their own history as well.
We do have a call on line one. Wiley, are you there? Hello?
Yeah, this is Wiley.
Yes. What's your question?
No, it's not a question. My grandmother survived the 1946 tsunami.
Mm.
And she and her husband were living in Keokaha in a two-story house. And about in January, my sister, my mother, and me came out on a trip from the mainland. I was 3 and a half, and my sister was 5. And then we went back to the mainland, and then my grandfather, who was part Hawaiian, died, I think, in February. My grandmother was in the house. It was a two-story house. And by happenstance, she was in her bedroom the morning that it happened. It was early in the morning. She looked out from this two-story house, saw the tide receding. She knew immediately that there was a tsunami coming. So she was in her nightgown, and she ran out of the house, ran into the jungle for about a mile, and there was about a 20 or 30 foot surge, hit the house, destroyed it. Now the interesting thing is, later on, the debris from the house was salvaged, and a one-story house was put in its place, and it's still there, and my sister's living in that house. Now, I remember the two-story house. I was 3 and a half years old in January 46, and I remember staying at that house that was subsequently destroyed. I vaguely remember it, but I was in that house. My sister was in the house, my mother, of course. And then that house was destroyed in April of 46, after we went back to the mainland. And my grandmother was part of the civil defense organization that worked with the federal government to get the tsunami warnings, to get the sirens implemented. So every time the sirens go off, I remember my grandmother.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Well, thank you so much for sharing that bit of history. Bill, I mean, that's, you know, that's what came out of that event.
No, exactly. And that, again, that knowledge, what Ken was talking about, of knowledge of the environment, as he said, as his grandmother saw the waters receding, she knew instantly what that was and what to do. And that, and then extending that to the community response in terms of leading to the alarms, that degree of community involvement as well is mm-hmm. really part of when I listen to these oral histories, I'm struck by that as well. You know, Steamy Chow, the policeman who just jumped in, did what was needed, and then in 1960 was again called on to do similar work, and just the appreciation for the people in our community, and again that self-knowledge, that self-awareness mm-hmm. as well as part of that.
And, you know, his account, too, of the ice plant, right? I mean, you know, I know where I grew up on another island, we had an ice plant. And of course, you know, everybody goes, you know, there to get ice to keep their drinks cool, but then to think it's been turned into a morgue.
I know. I was chilling, honestly, that word. But yeah, it was. I never put the two together because it's ice plants right there down by the ocean.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That was incredible.
And anything else you're struck by?
I was going to ask Deviana in terms of just when it comes to organizing or approaching these, because you have these stories, these collections, and putting them together in a way that does make sense and that is something that folks can plug into, can learn from. What are some of the challenges involved with doing that?
With collecting it or with
just sort of the organizing and turning around into actual segments? Almost.
Yeah, well, I think up until this point, most of the effort has gone into just collecting and transcribing and making sure we have an accurate record from the informant and the narrators, and then putting them on Scholar Space, which is where they are now. At Hamilton, UH Manoa Hamilton Library Scholar Space has all of these 800 interviews that we've done over the years. So now we want to go in back into the transcripts and make them available through these small stories, you know. And so we have students who and our graduate student and undergraduate students who are going through all the stories and then highlighting what we feel are important, you know, good, nice extracts that we can make into a soundbite for the purpose of the podcast. Or actually, we also want to do small short stories that we could put online and have a map to show where it is that people are talking about. It'd be nice to take this oral history of the tsunami and sort of map the locations that these different individuals were when they're talking about Mamo Street and, you know, running on and being on the bridge. Where was that? And help to visualize these events. So that's what we want to do at this next stage with what we have as collections. It's and then we have to go back because we have the audio tapes also archived at the Hamilton Library. And we have to go back then and match. Sometimes there are sections of audio interviews that were not into, didn't make it into the transcript, that the narrator deleted it. So we have to make sure the narration matches the approved transcript, and then we can put it together into a story.
So these are all digitized already?
Yes, they are. Well, not all of them. Most of them are. We're doing it now in the process of putting together these podcasts. And I just want to acknowledge, too, that the Hawaii Council for the Humanities has made the funds available for us to be able to do this.
That was going to be my next question, is funding for digitizing.
Yes. So that's one source, is the Hawaii Council for the Humanities and for the programming that will go with this project. And we'll have public programs. Our first one is going to be on Wednesday, November 14th at 4:30 at our center, which is in George Hall 212. And we'll be having extending this conversation about the tidal wave and tsunami. And, you know, hope we other people who are interested can come and share their experiences if they want, or stories they know about it, or inquire more about how do we be prepared to respond when short-term notice is upon us.
And Ken, you know, what else are you struck by? Because, you know, with this, in this day and age, with the technology out there, you know, people have a chance to know things instantaneously. But these voices that we're hearing, these stories, are so powerful.
Yeah, I agree. They make it real. And what I'm struck by is, you know, we've had several of these events over the last 5 or 6 years where we've been given warnings, and sometimes people feel like, oh, that was a false warning. And I'm not talking about the missile. I'm talking about tsunami.
Okay.
That do arrive here, but they end up being smaller. And I think it's when each one of those come, I myself reflect on what happened in 1946 and in 1960, And I think I'm thankful that we have that system, even if it's inconvenient, even if you know, our civil defense managers and the public and the media, everyone can be better at learning, you know, how to convey the information, and not every wave that comes to Hawaii is destructive like this. Most of them, the vast majority of them, aren't. But you know, better safe than not. And this is one of the ways in which technology has really changed our lives. We have an expectation of having information right away. But that doesn't mean that the information is always 100% vetted, that it's accurate. And so being able to filter that and make the best of it, that's important. And it's one of the things I think these voices help. The, you know, 60 years ago already was the 1946 event, and I think a lot of people, actually 70 years, I guess. And, so that's kind of lost from most of our memories. There's still people with grandparents that were involved, but getting fewer. And having these voices is a way of bringing that back for all of us, and to remind us that we do live in a place where these events happen. They're not as infrequent as people think. Maybe something like four a century that are big enough to cause loss of life, and that's important for all of us to keep in mind.
I do worry because, you know, you do see things on TV and there's this fear factor that's magnified, whether you're watching a storm approach someplace on the mainland, and then it's like, oh, you know, not much happened. And so you worry that the next time, you know, people are just going to poo-poo the warnings, and then we'll be in serious trouble.
Yep, it happens. I think, you know, a good example of that, though, in the opposite was, look at Hurricane Michael, right? That came up very quickly. Mm-hmm. People were warned. Some people didn't take the warnings very seriously because it came very quickly. And then I think it was a devastating storm, but there was, unfortunately, you know, more loss of life than there probably needed to be if more people evacuated. And so I would always choose to take the inconvenience of having a warning and responding than not. And I hope the general population tries to think that way too. I know our daily lives are very scheduled and scripted, and people don't like a sudden event that changes their routine, especially when it turns out not to be something. But isn't it better to be safe than sorry?
You know, I'm just thinking of the missile alert and the things that people did or didn't do. You know, like, okay, I've got to go get my child. You know, she's at school in a school program, and she's, you know, she's on the phone and she's hysterical. And so, you know, as a parent, you think, okay, I've got to go be with my child. But, you know, as we've seen over many of these events, sometimes the gridlock that's created in a panic causes real problems.
Well, the nature also in terms of the lead time, and Ken, you were mentioning earlier in terms of that real difference, because hurricanes as well, now we have such a lead time out, and while not knowing targeting with precision, certainly in terms of potential impacts. And with tsunamis, really there has been a I don't know, as more of these happen, not more statistically, but as they happen with the closer focus of science on them, and whether that's in Japan, whether that's the Boxing Day tsunami, there are, each of these events come with a set of lessons, really, that scientists take from this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we live on a dynamic and restless planet. And, you know, the vast majority of the population lives in the coastal zone. And that's a place that is particularly exposed to a lot of different kinds of hazards. And, you know, we're not always – sometimes things come up very quickly, like earthquakes. We're not able to predict them with any kind of reliability. And they can be very devastating. We've had 30 what we would call very large earthquakes, meaning larger than magnitude 6, in the last 150 years or so here in Hawaii. And, you know, only a small number of them caused tsunami, but a large number of those quakes caused damage, in some cases loss of life. And being aware, knowing when the ground is shaking, what to do right away is very important. Actually, the U.S. Geological Survey sponsors this thing called the Great Shakeout. It just happened last week all around the country. Here in Hawaii, there was an event, you know, where school kids and are basically taught what to do. I grew up in California, and so we used to have these drills all the time where you learn how to get under your desk and curl up into a ball and hope for the best. But, you know, it's at least being aware that these things happen, what they mean or what they might mean, and how to protect oneself is a critical, you know, part of being able to survive through a disaster.
September 1st every year in Japan, on the anniversary of the September 1st, 1923 Great Kanto Earthquake. That's school kids. That's sort of the drill day for that, certainly, as well.
Yeah, well, I'm just really grateful that we've got this opportunity to present this information, that it's been recorded, because I think of, you know, this whole, you know, younger generation that has no memory of this, no knowledge of it. Maybe they just might know the tsunami alert and how they drove up to the Pali and then nothing happened. Or they, you know, were over in Lanikai and they went up to the hillside and nothing happened and they saw a teeny weeny wave. So I'm really grateful to be able to hear these voices, to be able to bring these events to life again.
Yeah, it's really good.
And that's, again, back to the nature of oral history and what you're doing with other projects in mm-hmm. this direction, in terms of, I guess, two steps of preserving, getting voices, preserving the voices, but then also presenting them to later generations.
Yeah, so we're other projects that we're going to be working on to go into the archive and make podcasts with will be a story about Waikiki and people's memories about how abundant the marine life used to be offshore and how important it is for us to be aware of what happened at Waikiki and to take more responsibility as a community to protect our resources. We're also going to look at plantation life on different islands and how that helped to shape our community today. And women in work, especially women who went into the pineapple cannery business and lay makers as well, and Waipio Valley and small businesses, and as well as the founding of the ABC stores.
Ah, interesting. A whole chain of chain of historical events here. Yes.
I think we've got a call on the line. Hello.
Oh, yes, hello. Yeah, I was curious real quick. I know you're coming to the end. I grew up on the island of Oahu, remembered the 1960 tsunami vividly, and we had evacuated. But then my dad decided, well, let's go home. Nothing's happening. And I was wondering what the confusion was on that night, because we knew that something was generated, but a lot of us went back home. So maybe you could answer that.
Well, I guess I could give a stab at that. So the series of waves that come in on a tsunami can last several hours, and they come and go. And there was some inundation here on this island, especially in the Lanikai area. And I think this was relatively early on, I guess, in our in the state, or what, you know, it had just become a state at that time, with people's sort of getting comfortable or used to there being a disaster response and an agency that was sort of giving them information about what may or may not be happening. And I guess it wasn't sort of universally accepted at that time that the information that was coming to them was exactly accurate. And so some people thought, you know, well, maybe this wasn't so accurate, and that was a kind of a natural response, was to sort of pack it in and go back to their homes.
Quick spot of history on that, actually. That 1960 earthquake, this is from NOAA's National Weather Service Pacific Tsunami Warning Center history period. That quake and the reaction to it led to a more coordinated international effort on communication involving, of course, Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, but also groups by way of the United Nations and in Japan, elsewhere in the Pacific, to coordinate that information, make sure that it sort of made its way through in a more accurate way.
Yeah, and the Pacific Ocean and all the countries that rim it and that are in the center of it are covered by a very advanced system. And unfortunately, other parts of the world, especially the Indian Ocean, didn't have that kind of system. And that's partly why there was so much what we call far-field devastation from the Boxing Day tsunami.
And even more recently, the boys in Indonesia being without without power, a lot of them not functioning and not functioning as part of that chain.
Yeah, vulnerabilities, I guess, in all our systems, right, worldwide. Mm. Anything else you'd like to add or underscore as we close out the program today?
Well, I just hope that if there is the listeners have suggestions for projects that would be of interest, be it a historical event or community life or a place that's very important to document, to call us. They could call 956-7068, or they could go online to look for us. We're within the College of Social Sciences and in the Department of Ethnic Studies, and we have our website there. And what we shared today will be put into a podcast and will be accessible on our site there. And then they can also access other stories through the scholar space at Manoah Hamilton Library.
Okay, but thank you. Great, great resource, and we're really proud that we are helping to bring this out back into the community again. Bill Dorman and I would like to thank our guests, Daviana McGregor and Ken Rubin. We'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. And if your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the TalkBack line and leave us your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.